What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Let's kick this thing off. Wes Barton is co-founder and managing partner of Third Prime. He started his career as a tobacco farmer, spent time on Wall Street, and now is focused on venture capital. Third Prime is a venture capital firm that likes to invest in entrepreneurs shaping a better future for humankind. In this conversation, we discuss what is happening in middle America, the current income disparity, Nashville and other emerging geographies for VC, and Wes's thesis around health and wealth. I really enjoyed this conversation with Wes, and I hope you do as well. Before we get into this conversation, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. First up is Diginex. They're the first crypto exchange to be publicly listed, and they're going to do it on the NASDAQ. Diginex is the proud owner of an exchange called Equos, E-Q-U-O-S, E-Q-U-O-S. And it's been built to institutional standards, but it's available to everyone. You can trade Bitcoin and Ethereum spot, as well as Bitcoin perpetuals, and you'll get a 5% discount on all fees by signing up using equos.com/pomp. Again, Diginex is the first cryptocurrency exchange to be listed in the United States, listed on the NASDAQ. They've got an exchange called Equos. And if you go to equos.com/pomp, you can sign up and get a 5% discount on all trading fees. Go check them out. If you want to talk to our second sponsor, you probably have a retirement account. Choice, their new self-directed IRA product that I'm really excited about. Right now, most of you listening who have a retirement account probably haven't looked at it in a while. My guess is that they've got you in some sort of quote-unquote safe portfolio, which is a 60-40 type exposure. The problem is that 40% in bonds, it's now a zero rate interest environment. You basically are losing money on a big portion of your portfolio because the real return is negative. Go check your retirement account. Don't worry about what you're going to do about it. Go check your retirement account if you're listening to this. And make sure that you're not sitting in a 60-40 portfolio in a zero interest rate environment. That is a disaster. If you would like to add Bitcoin to your retirement account, you can use Choice. It's a new self-directed IRA product. They are allowing people to buy Bitcoin in the retirement account, hold the private keys, and use tax-advantaged dollars to do it. So if you're worried, like I am, about having any sort of inflation hedge assets, or you're worried that your 40% of your 60-40 portfolio in a zero interest rate environment is actually losing you money, you can put Bitcoin in your retirement account. It's awesome. I do it. Go and get a Choice account. Retirewithchoice.com/pomp. Again, retirewithchoice.com/pomp. Buy Bitcoin in your retirement account, own your private keys, and use tax advantage dollars to do it. No brainer, absolute game changer. Retirewithchoice.com/pomp. Lastly, don't forget that I write a daily letter to over 75,000 investors about business, technology, and finance. I break down complex topics into easy to understand language while sharing my personal opinion on various aspects of each industry. You can subscribe at pompletter.com. Again, pompletter.com. All right, let's get into this episode with Wes. I hope you guys enjoy this one.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys. Bang, bang. I've got Wes here with me. Thank you so much for doing this.
Hey, glad to be here, Pomp. You know, big fan of the show and excited to chat with you today.
Absolutely. So right off the bat, everyone's going to hear that you don't talk like I talk, which is a compliment because you ended up with a Southern accent. So let's get right into your background. Where are you from and how the hell do you end up doing venture capital having lived in New York for a number of years?
Yeah, well, Pomp, I like to joke. I think I might be the first grain and cattle farmer turned venture capitalist. Grew up a little town called Glasgow, Kentucky. We thought, you know, going to Pizza Hut was a fancy restaurant. If that tells you anything, you know, about 10,000 people here in my town. and, you know, spent the last 20 years in New York City. I'm actually back in Nashville now, which we might touch on a little bit. But yeah, you know, my way into venture capital. So again, started small town Kentucky, very, very winding road for me. So I thought, like my forefathers, I'd probably end up, you know, farming as well. Really all I knew, to be honest with you. Went to the local college. I went to Western Kentucky. I was actually the first in my family to go to college. That was a big deal. And, you know, we like to joke, you know, Western Kentucky is the Harvard of Southern Kentucky. You know, so they were awfully proud. The lens, you know, got widened just a little bit, I guess, when I was in college. You know, now I had a few people from Nashville and Louisville, you know, which were the big cities. You know, from there, I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't farm. Maybe there are some other opportunities out there. Ended up going to Duke for law school. And, you know, Pop, I think you're from Raleigh. So obviously, you know, so that neck of the woods, but, you know, the aperture widened even more at that point, you know, started meeting folks coming from New York and, you know, all over the world, actually. And, you know, really got excited about what I could do. And, you know, from there ended up going and joining Skadden Arps, a law firm up in New York City, practice M&A law. You know, there for about 3 years, you know, representing a lot of private equity firms, hedge funds, you know, likes of Carlyle and Apollo and all those guys, and really, you know, got excited about, you know, what they were doing and said, you know what, maybe I don't want to be a lawyer. I actually want to be an investor. I want to sort of get over to that side of the table. And, you know, had the good fortune of joining a middle market private equity firm coming out of Skadden called Trimaran. You know, from there, we were, you know, investing in businesses across industries. I got to sit on boards. I got to work with entrepreneurs. You know, really fantastic experience working with some really good people. And we also ended up spinning up a hedge fund while I was there as well with the guys from Trian, Nelson Peltz and those folks who got to, you know, evaluate public companies and, you know, really sort of develop a pretty unique toolkit, you know, from, you know, the law to, you know, then private equity and sort of the public markets. But really what I would say, Pop, is, you know, having spent about a decade in, you know, private equity and public equities, really started to notice some structural tailwinds. And, you know, to date myself a little bit here, that's going back to about 2010. You know, on the PE side, you know, it was just everything was coming through an auction. You really started to see return compressions, you know, sort of across that asset class. Same thing on the publics, right? You know, just fewer public companies, more and more money coming into hedge funds. You know, the rise of the quants and, you know, the computers, and just really hard to be a stock picker there as well. So I started thinking about, well, where might there be some structural tailwinds and, you know, where might, you know, I sort of, you know, be best served to spend the rest of my career. And so really it started as more of a, you know, a decision, just thinking about, you know, sort of asymmetry around returns and where I could generate some alpha, and really started thinking that, you know, early stage, whether it be micro PE or sort of venture capital, really sort of afforded a lot of opportunity. On the back of that, I started investing off my own balance sheet back in 2010, sort of testing this hypothesis. And, you know, me and a couple guys that ultimately, you know, sort of launched Third Prime, which we'll get into, you know, put just under $1 million into a little company called Jingle Punks. You know, fast forward 2 years later, we sold to William Morris Endeavor. It was a fantastic, you know, sort of outcome from a financial standpoint, but more importantly, taught me a lot that, all right, I love sort of, you know, getting my hands dirty, working with these entrepreneurs sort of from day one or sort of being that first check-in. We were on the board there. We were, you know, making a lot of decisions over, you know, probably too many beers and whatnot, but it all worked out. And from there said, you know what, this is really what I want to do. You know, going all the way back to, you know, little kid as a farmer, it'd been a, you know, winding road, but, you know, now I finally see it. This is it. Spent the next few years while I still had the day job, still working, you know, at Trimaran, putting a track record together just via SPVs, going into, you know, individual companies. And, you know, on the back of that, you know, quit the day job, launched Third Prime in 2016. Now investing out of our second fund, we've got $100 million, under management. And, you know, really, you know, like I said, we got the office in New York. I'm launching an office in Nashville, which I'm very, very excited about that city and sort of what we can do from that standpoint. And, you know, really also focused on investing in health and wealth, which I think is, you know, sort of, you know, has grown from sort of what I've seen, you know, here in Kentucky, having been back since, you know, almost, you know, what is it, 7-8 months now through COVID and, you know, sort of the disparities that a lot of folks here are facing versus what I saw in New York.
Yeah. So first of all, you've had this really kind of winding road where you've touched a lot of parts of just company building in general and kind of seen from different seats from an application standpoint. But one of the things I really wanted to talk about with you is most people listening to this and somewhat of an overgeneralization, but most people are going to be living in a major metro. So they're going to be living in New York, San Francisco, maybe LA, Austin, et cetera. Those places are great. I live in New York, right? So have no complaints in that bucket, but they're very different than what we'll call kind of middle America, right? Or kind of other areas that are not those major metros. You have this unique experience of kind of going back and forth and really looking at some of the middle America opportunities. Maybe let's just spend some time talking about like what are the differences and kind of give us a crash course for those of us that live in the major metros. Like what's going on in middle America that may surprise us or we may not be aware of?
Yeah. Yeah, look, I think it's a great question. I do feel very fortunate to sort of be a bridge into both communities, and they're very, very different. What I would say, first is what's the same, right? I mean, people care about their families. They're trying to provide. They're focused on their communities. What you see that's so different though is you're walking around New York, San Francisco. Yeah, you might see somebody that's a little bit overweight every now and then, but you come into the small town Kentucky here, and it's just frankly obesity is rampant. Opioid abuse, right? Just sort of ill health is pervasive. There is what I would also say, and it's really unfortunate, and it's something that I'd love to sort of, try to improve is, there's just a bit of lack of hope, right? And, I think, you might see that, with Trump coming into the presidency and people looking to sort of rebel and, hey, what's been going on just hasn't worked for me, right? Hasn't worked for these folks in the red states. You see, real economic stagnation. You find just, empty factories, just across the landscape. And it's really sad in a lot of respects, right? I talk to people down here, sort of in Kentucky and really try to sort of probe into, how they're thinking about things. And, you hear that, look, it's just, I don't feel like the opportunity is there anymore, right? I tried to follow this path. I've tried to go, do what my, dad did and granddad did and whatnot. And it's not leading to the same place. And I think there's, just immense frustration around that. And people that don't really know where to turn, right? There certainly is, high unemployment down here. And you see sort of automation, you worry about, how that's impacting their jobs. And, I think we could, we could dig into several things, but it's, when people say, sort of the world of haves and have nots, I mean, it's absolutely true. And you just see it all over the place.
Yeah, it's really interesting. My parents both live in an area in kind of rural North Carolina, right outside of a place called Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina, which basically has got three or four stoplights in it. But one of the things that is really interesting is when Plin and I were down there last time, we were driving kind of through the main strip, if you will. And this main strip all of a sudden just hit us. Every single food outlet was fast food. I mean, you couldn't eat healthy there if you tried, right? And unless you went to the grocery store and you actually went home and you cooked and all that kind of stuff. But I'm talking about everything from Arby's to Chick-fil-A to, all the way on down. And it's one of these things where you got to ask yourself, like take obesity, for example, how much of that is you're a product of your environment and how much of that is no, actually it's a poverty problem, right? And an unemployment problem. And therefore there's not a lot of capital. And so the only food that you're going to be able to buy is kind of cheap, fast, kind of QSR, if you will, type restaurants. And so any thoughts in terms of maybe kind of cyclically how this is playing out? Is it a poverty issue? Is it an education issue? Is it a just people want to do what they want to do? And so that's just kind of the lifestyle they choose. Like help me unpack why this is happening more so than just like what's happening.
Yeah. Look, I think a few components to that, certainly education. I think we could do a better job of letting them know, how they should be eating. Right. And that probably starts in the schools and, in the communities, churches, whatnot. But, I think second to that, minimum wage here is $7.25 an hour, right? And so if you get a job, most people are getting $7.25. And you think about that, right? Like there's just not much you can do. You're not going to go buy organic produce making $7.25 an hour. You just can't, right? And you go to McDonald's and you buy the value meal. Right. Because that's really what you can afford. And so I do think, you know, that there are several sort of, aspects to it. And then also just the dearth of options, as you touched on, even the grocery stores, though, many of them, the grocery stores are going out and all you're doing is shopping at a Dollar General. Right. And there, you know, you grab a bag of Doritos or, you know, you get, you know, some, you know, sugary cereal. That's just kind of what's happening. And so I think it's a bit of a vicious cycle there. And you know, I don't believe there's a quick or easy fix, but it's something that, like I said, is just, it's just pervasive, and it's incredibly sad.
Yeah. I actually, speaking of Dollar General, I forget where I read this, maybe it was a filing or an article or something, but that's basically been their strategy, right? Is to go find kind of the smaller communities where it's too small for a Walmart to go. But the Dollar General is kind of the perfect, compromise, if you will, for the community. And like you're saying, you know, they don't even have kind of fresh food deli or any of that. It's all packaged food and kind of not, you know, overly healthy stuff. As you guys are investing, like, how do you see, let's stick on kind of just the health issues, right? How do you see the solutions coming together? Are these companies that are being built by kind of tech entrepreneurs and the major metros, and they're going to go and kind of save middle America? Or are these more kind of what I'll call homegrown solutions, where it's going to take people who are not in the major metros, who understand these problems, kind of very intimately and can kind of build the solutions that way?
You know, look, I think it's both. And, you know, you go to, you know, our portfolio, and I'll take two examples. So we've got, you know, a company called The New Primal that's based out of Charleston, South Carolina. And I hope you mind me sort of telling this story, but, you know, Jason Burke, the CEO over there, you know, grew up incredibly, you know, impoverished, right? And sort of saw all these issues. I know his parents had, you know, problems with, you know, with obesity and health problems. And that served as the catalyst for him to say, you know what, like, I'm going to go try to improve things. And so, you know, sort of he started in beef jerky because he thought, oh, this is healthy. I'm going to go out here and start eating beef jerky. Little did he know that it's just, you know, it's a wolf in sheep's clothing, full of sugar, sort of full of things that are just, you know, terrible for you. And so he started by, you know, sort of cleaning up, you know, that product. And, you know, fast forward to today, the business is really, you know, really booming. And he's doing, you know, cooking sauces and salad dressings and really just trying to, you know, be out there with, sort of a narrative around, you know, how to sort of think about that educational component, how to go back to the table, how to eat with your family and your communities, right, in a healthy and approachable way. And look, is it more expensive than some alternatives? Of course, but he's very much trying to, you know, bring that cost down, very sort of mindful that, you know, initial mission, which was to try to sort of address, you know, some of these pervasive problems, you know, around health and, you know, ingredient panels and whatnot. The second one is somebody that's coming from a very different standpoint, right? An investment that we're you know, recently made in a company called 28 Health, which is, you know, two folks that have been, you know, from Bain and, you know, the Gates Foundation and sort of all this stuff, sort of saw it from a very different angle, but have launched a product that's catering to underserved women, digital health, telemedicine, all that stuff, starting with birth control and sort of just access to that. Which again, I think people just don't realize, you know, sort of how difficult it is for, you know, sort of, you know, maybe a, you know, a woman in one of these communities to go to a doctor to actually get birth control. And they don't want to have a child, but they end up having one. And, you know, what that costs the system and what that costs them and sort of just the snowball effect of that. So I believe that the solution is being provided from all sides. And it's just, you know, those folks that are determined to do it. And, you know, to the extent that we can play a small role in that, you know, via, you know, capital and, you know, trying to provide some insights is something we're super, super excited about.
Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about the wealth side of this health and wealth thesis, right? So obviously, something that I just go back to over and over and over again is the lack of financial education should be a national emergency, right? In terms of our country. I don't think that many people see this play out, right? If you kind of live in a major metro, you basically see kind of the most extreme ends of the two Americas, you know, if you want to think of it that way. You see kind of the ultra wealthy, and then you see kind of the homeless, drug addict, you know, type, you know, narrative or path in life. But that kind of middle class is not as obvious kind of on the streets of a New York or San Francisco. In middle America, it is the middle class, right? And there is pretty pervasive. And so talk through a little bit just about the financial education and kind of the issues around wealth and money.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So you know, one of the things that I sort of, you know, take issue with, or say take issue with it. But anyway, you know, you keep hearing now about this K-shaped recovery, right? That that, you know, the folks that own stocks are doing great. The folks that don't are really suffering. And when you look, it's, you know, I think the latest data I saw is about 85% of the stock market is owned by, you know, 10% of households, right? And, you know, most of that is sitting in New York and San Francisco and sort of where you and I are interacting, you know, in the venture ecosystem and whatnot. But, you know, sort of sitting here, you know, in Kentucky and in Nashville, you know, you really, you know, sort of see the difference between what's happening in the stock market versus what's happening in the real economy, right? And, you know, I think, you know, it was New York Times was also talking, you know, what was it last weekend about, you know, sort of Milton Friedman and that seminal work around, you know, sort of shareholders, right? And, you know, a business, you know, what they need to do is just try to drive value for shareholders. And that probably worked 50 years ago. But I think what we're seeing now is it doesn't, right? Because it just, this disconnect, right? This income disparity has grown so large that there's just got to be a different solve for it. And so I think whether it's business roundtable stuff, talking about stakeholder capitalism, whether it's us thinking about investing in companies that are, you know, sort of solving for all stakeholders, that's a big part of it. And you know, Pop, to go back to your question about, you know, education, yes, I think we could be telling them more, right? Like, hey, here's how you should invest. And, you know, here's, you know, sort of what you should do to be responsible around credit and whatnot, but they just don't have much to start with, right? So we've got to find ways to try to put more into their pocket. You know, I think, it's sort of, you know, first principle. And then, you know, clearly that'll come with it. But, yeah, I give a lot of thought to, you know, sort of that widening gap. And it just, you know, every time I sort of come home, I think it gets, you know, it gets greater and greater. And there's, you know, if you go to Third Prime's website, it says, you know, a reckoning is coming, right? And it was sort of about what we were seeing. And this was before sort of, you know, Trump was elected and you see sort of people going to the streets now and you know, just this real divide. But, you know, I almost think we need to revise that website and say the reckoning is here, right? I really feel like it's on us. And if we don't do something about it, you know, and I'm not saying that I'm smart enough to know all the answers, but I know something has to be done, right? Or we're moving to a really bad place.
I read a book, and I'm going to screw up the name, but Hillbilly Elegy, I think is how you pronounce it. And it was eye-opening, right? And this is coming from somebody who grew up in North Carolina, you know, generally thought I understood some of these issues, but by no means lived in a, you know, 10,000-person town or smaller. And the book specifically, if I remember correctly, talked about West Virginia, right? And kind of a lot of the opioid crisis and the poverty and just this world that almost sounded like a third world country, right? I mean, it really was not something that you would have believed could happen in America to some degree. And so it sounds like this is much more pervasive than just, you know, the coal mines of West Virginia type thing. This is actually happening across states, you know, between these major metros. And it feels like it's systemic in the sense of there's so much reinforcement to this, right? Whether it's the health, the wealth, just this is not something where we go in and we just give people some money and they're okay, right? And maybe talk a little bit about like, how do you balance in your mind between like, we have to change a system versus we can actually come up with, I'll call them band-aid solutions, right? Or kind of things that directly address the acute problem. Like, how do you balance that? And where do you think the solution lies?
Yeah, you know, look, I think it's not just, you know, universal basic income or putting, you know, sort of money in somebody's pocket, right? Like that's, yes, that helps, right? And that's a near-term fix. But what we've got to do is, you know, people want to work, right? They take pride in their work. You know, they come home from a hard day and they feel good about themselves, right? I mean, I'm sure you do and you know, I do as well. So like they want to have that purpose. And so I think that you know, really we have to sort of get to the root of the problem, which is just, again, how do we, you know, how do we sort of create jobs? How do we do things that, you know, that make them feel like that there's that purpose? And, you know, they come home and, you know, they're setting a good example for their child and, you know, for contributing to their community. So that's, you know, that's something where, you know, I read that book as well. I think J.D. Vance has a very unique perspective. You know, I don't know that he's got the prescription either, right? But he's, you know, from what I understand, he's trying to get into politics now or thinking about that. So obviously he sees that certainly as a way that, you know, he can sort of enact change. I think we've got to do it from the public side and the private side, you know, sort of working in tandem. And, you know, I'm very much a capitalist, but I do think that it's going to take, you know, folks at the top, you know, sort of giving back more, you know, the progressive tax system, you know, we probably got to be, you know, even more progressive about that. Somehow trying to sort of create this balance, right? But it's just, you know, bringing back jobs, trying to create, you know, something that, allows these people to, you know, feel like they really got a purpose. That's, you know, sort of the biggest issue to me when people say, hey, we can go out here, we can put money in their mailbox, but it's still going to break. Right. Because they just don't have that sense of purpose and what they're supposed to do with their life.
Yeah. How much of this is around entrepreneurship in these communities as well? Right. So it's kind of become cool for certain demographics of people to move to San Francisco or New York or LA and start a company and be a founder and kind of do that type of stuff. It may not be as cool if you're not building a technology company, for example, or you may not have the skills to do that type of business, but there's obviously opportunity in each one of these towns. Is there kind of the same rise in popularity of entrepreneurship in kind of middle America, or kind of how do you see that having evolved in light of what you see in the Silicon Valley type areas?
Yeah. Honestly, despite, people being on Twitter and reading TechCrunch and, your letter every day, right? You don't find that sort of permeating little towns like Glasgow, Kentucky, where I am, right? And so it's, entrepreneurship for the most part is, starting a plumbing company, right? Or opening a used car lot. Or, buying a Subway franchise, right? So they are certainly impacted. They're on TikTok, they use Instagram and Facebook and all this stuff as well. But it's certainly not, sort of pervasive through this ecosystem to start thinking about technology. They're not talking about coding. They're not talking about, the things that you and I are probably often sort of, encountering on a regular basis. So that, again, to bring us back to sort of the educational piece, right? How can we change, curriculums in schools, maybe to reframe it, to sort of do some of these jobs that are going to be more future-proof? I think that's a big part of it. But again, these disconnects that I'm talking about, right? The what's happening on the coast versus what's happening in the middle. It's not just, sort of the obesity and the health problems. It's, again, it's educational. It's sort of aspirational. There's a lot of aspects to it.
And then from your guys' investment thesis, is it purely technology, or will you guys go and invest in some of these other businesses that maybe don't have the, zero to a billion users as part of the plan?
Yeah. So obviously, we are, a venture capital firm and, we've got limited partners and we're trying to, provide, the best return we can as fiduciaries. So certainly, technology is pervasive across our portfolio. But, as I said before, we're investing in that company, The New Primal, right? Which is, started with beef jerky and now has moved into some other foods. Obviously more and more venture capital firms are investing in, sort of consumer and products and whatnot these days. But, by and large, it is technology. What I would say about us though is, we've spent about half our capital, in sort of what we call sort of secondary and sort of tertiary geographies, right? So we've got, entrepreneurs we're working with in places like Greensboro, North Carolina, and, Richmond, Virginia, and Huntsville, Alabama, right? And very much see increasing opportunities to sort of go into some of these, these communities and to try to wave the flag and say, hey, look, we're here, to support. We are, I think, probably more flexible, have a more flexible mandate than many firms. That said, tech is by and large a big, big component of all we're doing.
One of the things that I've always struggled with, right, and especially coming from a place like Raleigh, North Carolina, is, how big can the businesses get there? Not from an aspiration of the entrepreneur, not from a kind of competency standpoint or a value of an idea, but really around the talent it takes to build some of these companies. And if you're in a San Francisco or New York, you just have access to a bigger pool of talent. Right now, there's more competition for that talent, but it definitely is bigger. How do you guys think through, being able to build a company in a Huntsville or a Greensboro, North Carolina, from a talent perspective? And is it something where remote work becomes much more important because you can kind of tap into a global workforce? Or do you see, no, we can actually find the right talent necessary just there locally?
Obviously, remote work is helping, right? Because you don't necessarily have to be sitting in that location. But you do bring up a great point. Frankly, there's just not the level of talent that you need to build a $1 billion business in many of these places. And that's why, we've got the office, our headquarters has been in New York City, and we're going to have the second headquarters in Nashville, right? But we still feel like it is crucial to have that connection to New York, to those talent pools, to that, you know, sort of Series A and B, you know, capital. So I think while improvements are being made, while Zoom is having an impact, while Slack and all these other things are having an impact, it's still not the full solve. You know, you're going to need to have a presence in some of these markets and some of these cities to extract, you know, some of that talent that's just not existing in some of these, you know, more nascent markets.
And so talk a little bit about kind of the funding environment in these towns, right? So obviously it's well understood kind of the metros, but in terms of whether it's Kentucky or Nashville or Alabama or North Carolina, like what does that funding environment look like for these founders?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's changing. You know, you see more and more firms, you know, that are sort of willing to invest in some of these communities. But, you know, by and large, I think there's still, you know, valuation arbitrage that, you know, I know Steve Case and the guys at Rise the Rest published something not so long ago that sort of suggested there's still a 30% discount, you know, in some of these markets relative to, you know, the Valley and so forth. I'd say that's fairly consistent with what we see. You know, so not only the valuation standpoint, but sort of an out, you know, sort of, you know, what comes from that is there's not as much competition, right? So oftentimes, you know, you're trying to do a deal in New York or San Francisco, good company's going to have multiple term sheets. You know, you're in Huntsville, you're probably the only game in town, right? You're probably the only one issuing a term sheet, or at least if you, you know, if you aren't, there's probably not too many around the table. And you know, to answer your question as well, sort of what's happening, if those VC firms aren't there, the gap, you know, is often sort of, you know, friends, family, some high net worth individuals that might be doing some things, but they're not dedicated to it, right? They're capital, but not much else. And they can't really provide that bridge to that Series A firm that's sitting in New York or San Francisco, which we feel like, you know, we've done a pretty decent job of doing.
Yeah. And one of the other aspects of these communities just over the years I've seen is kind of the rise of what I'll really call startup communities, right? And what I mean by that is everything from accelerators to co-working spaces and kind of down the line. These are things that usually are somehow incentivized by the government, right? Because it's good for job creation and things like that. But they tend to help an entrepreneur, you know, have an easier path. They obviously can't build the company. They tend not to, you know, be kind of advice driven in terms of sitting on boards or anything like that. But they provide everything from legal services to physical location, you know, to work out of, et cetera. I'm imagining that has had to have been an important kind of accelerant for a lot of this, but maybe you've got kind of a different perspective just having spent much more time looking at this. Like talk a little bit about some of those service providers and other things that are helping entrepreneurs get started in the non-metro cities.
Yeah, no, it is great. I think they've got resources today that they've never had. And, you know, the quality of that varies, you know, from town to town, city to city. You know, but nonetheless, I think it shows a dedication. It shows an appreciation for the need to try to be cultivating entrepreneurship in these communities. You know, for bringing, you know, not only the entrepreneurs together, but, you know, folks that might, you know, provide some seed capital. You know, that, like you said, those service providers. So I think that is, you know, sort of an early sign of sort of what's to come. It is, you know, attracting, you know, more and more talent. You know, we've been spending a lot of time, you know, in Charleston, South Carolina over the past few years. And it's been really interesting to sort of see sort of the quality of the entrepreneurs that are now coming out of that town, the number of those entrepreneurs. And I give, you know, sort of a lot of credit to sort of the local accelerators and some of the local sort of entrepreneurs and angel investors there that are really, you know, sort of engaged in that community. And I think, you know, they're now, you know, sort of the, you know, the prototypes are out there, right? So I think, you know, if a city's not doing it the right way, I think there are places they can look and sort of, you know, make sure they got the right roadmap.
Yeah. Well, hopefully there will be many, many more. I think we're moving to a world where it doesn't necessarily matter where you sit. If you can build a great business, you can do it from anywhere. Talk a little bit before we move into kind of the rapid fire to wrap up. Your investment thesis is very unique. And so what does that look like in terms of opportunities of what you guys are looking for? And then also, how focused are you on specific verticals, right? Versus just trying to find great entrepreneurs who are building awesome companies.
Yeah, no, you know, look, if you went back to sort of, you know, version one of Third Prime, you know, we were just, you know, frankly, trying to make money. That's kind of how we got into it, looking for the best sort of, you know, risk reward we could find. Kind of bringing that hedge fund, you know, mentality to it. You know, sort of, you know, fast forward to, you know, to sort of where we are today. And as I mentioned before, really focused on health and wealth, really focused on, you know, those entrepreneurs that, you know, believe sort of doing good is good business, finding that mission alignment. And I think that we're still, you know, returns are, you know, sort of objective number one. We're not an impact fund, right? Despite, you know, hoping to have, you know, a positive, you know, sort of influence on what's happening, you know, with our capital. But I think we do believe that sort of investing in health and, you know, that kind of a large, you know, sort of range there, you know, obviously, you know, sort of food companies, healthcare companies, even things that more environmental health. We've got some investments, you know, in sort of, you know, folks that are looking to reduce carbon emissions and, you know, things of that nature. You know, on the wealth side, you know, again, you know, fintech, you know, sitting in New York, we've done a lot of those deals, but, you know, really also trying to be thoughtful around who's providing a product or solution to sort of all Americans, not just sort of those that are sort of sitting along the coast. And I think we've got a bit of a competitive advantage there, again, sort of given the fact that I think I understand and know both of these communities. So really that's where we sit today. And you know, I think this new, you know, sort of vantage point sitting in Nashville is going to, you know, provide us a lot of unique exposure there as well.
So I got to ask, why Nashville?
Yeah, well, so again, you know, health and wealth, right? So you think New York, you think financial services, you think fintech, you know, Nashville, you think healthcare, right? And not only that, but, you know, I've got a lot of friends down there. I'm familiar with that city and it's pretty incredible, right? You know, if you come into Nashville, the number of cranes, you know, just the folks that you see moving in. I mean, you know, every time I talk to somebody, they'll tell me I'm you know, sort of the fifth person they've spoken with that week moving from New York, right? There's a lot going on. And not to say that, you know, that the ventures, you know, scene in Nashville is, you know, is lacking, but I believe we can, you know, we can have a, you know, a real impact there, especially outside of healthcare. We're obviously going to be investing in healthcare, but I think, you know, sort of the fintech and then, you know, there's a bit of a marriage too. I'm sure you've been thinking about embedded fintech and sort of how all that looks and, you know, just ways that all this stuff starts to converge, right? And sort of fintech moving into healthcare, we think there could be some really unique opportunities there. So that's the reason for Nashville.
Makes sense. Not too bad on the food, the beer, or the country music either, right?
Yeah. You know, and they're partial to my southern accent down there, so that's good.
I love it. Before we wrap up, two questions. Then you could ask me one to end it. First one is, what is the most important book that you've ever read?
You know, it's a good one. I would say that it was probably Breath to Air. I don't know if you've read that one. It's about the, you know, the neurosurgeon that unfortunately, you know, got lung cancer and, you know, wrote just an incredible, you know, incredible book about sort of that experience, unfortunately passed away. But, you know, for me, it was really sort of, you know, important in that, you know, I think we often think about, you know, all right, we're all going to pass away, right? But that sort of something just sort of shook me with that book and you know, it reminds me to be grateful about sort of what I had, to try to be present, to try to enjoy, you know, sort of every day, you know, and just, you know, kind of back to the point again, try to make an impact, right? And so if we can sort of give more to some of these communities, improve some of these communities, you know, it's something that I'd be awfully proud of.
Yeah, that's a fantastic book. And for those who are listening who think they only enjoy business books, I promise you will you'll like that one. Second question is a little bit more fun. Aliens, believer or non-believer?
Definitely a believer, right? I think it's a bit, you know, human arrogance to think that we could be the only form of life out there. So I'm definitely a believer in aliens.
No alien encounters or sightings down in Kentucky?
Not yet, but I keep my eyes open, man. I'll let you know if I see any.
I'm always surprised by, there's only two people ever who came on the podcast and asked about aliens and they said, no, I don't believe in aliens, but I believe in ghosts. And those two people happen to be Josh Brown from Ritz-Holt and Jim Cramer. And I said, of course, Jim Cramer believes in ghosts, and not aliens.
Yeah.
All right. You can ask me one question to finish up. What do you got for me?
Yeah, man. So you know, a lot of talk about the demise of the coastal cities and sort of the rise of middle America. Given what we've talked about here, where are you coming out on that?
More things change, the more they stay the same. I tend to think that maybe there's a little bit more of an equitable distribution now, just because some of the moats that the large cities had get broken down through remote work and kind of telecommunications and things like that. for me, you know, when I look at a New York, if New York doesn't come back to kind of the vibrant city that it once was across all kinds of different verticals, then basically you're not living in New York. You're just living in an overpriced apartment, right? If it comes back though, I tend to think that there will always be a very large percentage of people that want to live in an environment where there's just the collision of people and ideas and industries and kind of have access to so much so close to them. And so I think what, you know, this whole situation has really kind of forced people to just ask themselves, it's like, what do I want? Not what am I being forced to do? Because now I don't have to go to an office. What do I want? And I know a lot of people who are changing jobs and, you know, moving and kind of doing all that. And I know a lot of people who are just staying and saying, look, I was already doing what I want to do. So I think that obviously the change will get kind of all the headlines, because it's awesome to say, you know, there's a line around the corner at the U-Haul rental. But at the same time, you know, there's quite a few people who say, hey, you know, I'm in it for the long haul. So we'll see how it plays out. But I tend to think that you know, a lot of the short-term reactions might be a little overblown, and we really got to get the data on the long-term to see kind of what changes for real.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Listen, Wes, this is fantastic. You've got a very unique kind of perspective, just because you understand a place that actually majority of Americans live, but people in kind of the San Franciscos and New York, they just don't really get insight into. So thank you so much for taking time to do this. Where can people find you on the internet, find out more about Third Prime or any things you guys are doing?
Yeah. So you can find me on the internet. Pretty easy to remember, Farmer_VC. You know, as I said, I'll go with that one. And then our website, thirdprime.vc. You know, any entrepreneurs out there that are looking to solve problems for, you know, for middle Americans and, you know, sort of in that health and wealth, you know, sector, you know, would love to talk.
Farmer_VC might be one of the best Twitter handles that have come on this podcast.
Yeah, I can't hear it.
Absolutely, man. All right, listen, thank you so much for doing this. I think people are really going to enjoy it, and we will have to do this again in the future.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you having me on.